This is NewsHour from the BBC World Service with me, Tim Franks. How do you create a double agent? I realise it's something not many of you may need to know in practical terms, but double agents are one of the key assets for any intelligence agency, and that can matter to us all. In a moment, we'll be asking about the craft of turning an agent into a double. But first, the story of a former Al-Qaeda member who reportedly swore an oath of allegiance to Osama bin Laden before spending 8 years working undercover as a British spy. He's now spoken for the first time to the BBC. Ayman Dean was a jihadi with Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. Then he was picked up by the British Intelligence Service and took the dramatic decision to work for them. The BBC's Peter Marshall has the story.
I was there when Al-Qaeda was constructing their first workable chemical device. When you hear them talking about this with such glee and such deep psychopathic satisfaction that you can see in their eyes, you say to yourself, why do I have any moral misgivings about spying on you guys?
Ayman Dean is the spy who came in from Al-Qaeda, one of British intelligence's greatest assets in the fight against global jihad. He was there at the heart of the movement in Afghanistan and also among its supporters back here in the UK. For the first time, he's telling his story, how he became a founder member of Al-Qaeda.
Osama bin Laden welcomed me into the fold. He basically said that there will be many, many years of difficulties and hardship.
You swore an oath?
Yes.
What was the oath?
I give you an allegiance to fight alongside you in good times and in bad times and to fight the jihad against the enemies of God and to obey my commanders.
What were you doing when you were swearing the oath? Do you stand? Do you kneel? Do you...
You sit next to him on the floor, basically, and you have your hand on a copy of the Quran and you say it. Almost knees touching each other, basically.
Born in Saudi Arabia to a comfortable family, Ayman Dean grew up in the 1980s. A time and a place when opposition to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan made military jihad a noble concept. By the 1990s, there was a new cause, defending Muslims in Bosnia. At 16, he became a jihadi in what he says was a just war.
I would say it was the most eye-opening experience I ever had. I was a bookish nerd from Saudi Arabia just weeks ago, and then suddenly I find myself prancing up on the mountains of Bosnia, holding an AK-47, feeling a sense of immense empowerment. You still feel apprehensive about it, but with the first bullet fired, I felt all my fear gone.
Did you lose many friends?
Oh, yes, indeed. It happened.
On the battlefront?
Yes.
What was your feeling about that?
I was happy for them, and I was sad that I didn't go with them.
What, you said you weren't a martyr?
Yes, I was.
The Bosnian War was crucial. By its end, Ayman Dean, like so many others, was intent on searching out new fronts. This was to be permanent jihad. He'd been influenced by the man who later planned the 9/11 attacks on America, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Dean was now close to him and to others who'd soon become key figures in Al-Qaeda.
They were shrewd, clever. They were well-informed, and I think Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the impression I had at that time from him was that he was there in Bosnia in order to spot talent.
Ayman Dean went to Afghanistan, where he was first pupil and then teacher in training camps. And then, in 1998, things changed.
The American State Department says up to three bombs were set off this morning in the Kenyan capital Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam in Tanzania. According to the International Red Cross, 40 people died in Nairobi and police say at least five were killed in Dar es Salaam. In both cases, the blasts occurred near American embassies.
The bombings of two American embassies in East Africa were hailed by Al-Qaeda leaders as a triumph. But Dean says he recoiled at the hundreds of deaths and thousands wounded, many of them Muslims. He found the jihadist justification was their misinterpretation of a 700-year-old fatwa. He resolved to leave. On the pretext of needing medical treatment, he went to the Gulf. He's vague on detail here, but he was picked up and grilled by MI6. Within days, the troubled Al-Qaeda man was turned. Months of debriefing were to come.
7 months into the debriefings, that's when the suggestion, what about you going back to Afghanistan, basically, and doing some more work for us? My answer was unequivocally yes.
What did you do?
Collect as much information as possible.
Between 1998 and 2006, Eamon Dean says he worked undercover as a spy for Britain, both in Afghanistan and back in the UK. Then his cover was blown. Since when, he's led a quiet life. So why is he speaking out now?
To counter the arguments, to help people, and especially those who are tempted by the lure of what the Islamic State is offering, to understand that they are actually going into hell without knowing it.
Eamon Dean talking to the BBC's Peter Marshall about why he turned away from Al-Qaeda and became a double agent for British intelligence. All this is especially sensitive at the moment in Britain, given what are reported to have been the approaches made by the British intelligence agencies to the Islamic State militant Mohammed Emwazi. So how do those security services practice the art of luring in the first place? Michael Scheuer is a former senior agent with the CIA. Indeed, he was chief of the unit tracking Osama bin Laden.
There has to be a trigger that makes them come to you. Had the British met this man and had he been serving happily with Al-Qaeda, there was probably nothing we could offer him, be it money, a green card or immigration to a Western country, a woman. Any kind of temptation probably would not have worked. And so when you get an asset like this, an agent like this with this kind of access, more often than not, he comes to you ready to be persuaded to betray his compadres.
What you're essentially saying is that you need to assess whether that purported disaffection is genuine.
The disaffection is genuine, and also the access, sir. There's a lot of people who are selling access that they don't have in the intelligence world. And so you have to find out, is he who he says he is? Was he educated as he said he was? Had he been to Bosnia? But you also have to figure out if he has the kind of access he claims to have. Is he going to report on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, or is he going to be reporting to you on things that are around Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, and not really involving him?
At the moment, there's also a question being asked, certainly in Britain, about the way in which the British intelligence agencies approached Mohammed Emwazi, the man nicknamed Jihadi John, the Islamic State militant who's appeared in several beheading videos, because there were reports from those close to Mr. Emwazi that the British intelligence agencies approached him and said, unless you work for us, things could get rather heavy and hairy for you, and that only served to radicalise him further. Is that also a calculation as far as the intelligence agencies are concerned?
That almost never works. In terms of the British intelligence services, they're far more subtle and far more knowledgeable than many other services in the world. And it would seem to me that it's only common sense. If you threaten someone who is unsure about working for you, it's not going to make him more likely to do it. I've been reading the story about the Jihadi John, and it sounds a little like after-the-fact excuse-making. Very seldom does it work that you threaten someone and he'll go and risk his life for you, because once he's out of your sight, out of your control, your threats are meaningless.
This man, Eamon Dean, was run as a double agent for several years in the late 90s, early 2000s, when you were in charge of the hunt for Osama bin Laden for the CIA. Was his presence something that you were aware of?
Well, the British share reporting with us, sir, but we never knew, at least I did not know, and my immediate superiors did not know, that the British had someone who apparently was this close to Osama bin Laden. If we had known that, and we asked continuously, it would have been very helpful in persuading President Clinton at that time and George Tenet, who was the head of the CIA, to actually make an effort to kill Osama bin Laden. They were looking for a second thread of intelligence to match our own, to corroborate our own. And had we had this gentleman able to help us in saying, Mr. bin Laden lives in X, and he's usually there at X time, that would have went a long way, I think, to trying to persuade Mr. Clinton to kill him when he was in Afghanistan in 98-99.
Is there a modicum of frustration in your voice?
Well, there is a bit of a frustration, sir, because we had very good intelligence on Osama bin Laden's location based on our own efforts. And we always felt, the people who were working the issue, that our political masters wanted to avoid doing anything about bin Laden. And certainly they put the marker on the table that they wanted a second thread of intelligence that would corroborate our own. And in hearing this story today and in reading the interview, I am a little bit disappointed if it is true that this gentleman could have helped us locate Osama bin Laden at a particular place and time, and the British didn't give us the opportunity.
Can I also ask you today about another story which has broken within the last few hours, which is that the former CIA director, General David Petraeus, has pleaded guilty to the charge of mishandling classified material in the course of the affair that he was having with his biographer, Paula